Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. As always, here from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. On weekday mornings. And I'm very excited to welcome to the show my my next guest. He is the author of a book called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. I just want to say that I've not finished. I just got this book a few days ago, and I'm halfway through. I haven't finished it yet. But so far, it is a tremendous book. If you're a regular listener to the show, that you know that one of my big interests is comedy, and I've been following comedians and sketch comedy and all of that stuff for many, many years in the history of it. And this book is pretty essential, I think, in the history of comedy, comedians, and things like that in America. The author's name is Cliff Nesteroff, and we welcome Cliff to the show. Hi, Cliff.
Hey, how are you, Nick?
All right. Thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
Let me, first of all, ask about your background. You did stand up for a while, and you're also, I mean, obviously you're a writer because you wrote a book and things
yes,
like that.
Sir.
But you're a comedy writer as well. Tell me a little bit about your personal experience in comedy.
I did stand up from 1998 till 2006 in Toronto and Vancouver. I kind of called it quit. At that point, I was not in a position to move to the United States where I now live. So I was working in a small market in Vancouver, but did very well there. I had a cult following with my act, but ultimately was getting paid the same amount after 8 years that I was during my first year. So I kind of realized that writing would be far more lucrative, and so I just kind of moved into that field.
You said you had a cult following. What was your act like?
Well, I had two acts. I had one that was me, Cliff Nesteroff, my own voice, my own point of view, and nobody liked that act. And then I did another act that was a character. It was very gimmicky, very shticky, a old-time insult comic named Shecky Ray. And that was the one in which I had my greatest successes and got a great deal of press. But a lot of problems that stand-up comedians have sometimes where they create something that's very successful, or is a hit with an audience, it creates a bit of a monster where it is demanded of you and grow sick of doing the same shtick over and over. So with me, I was doing this gimmicky act that was getting a lot of attention, but at the same time, I was sick and tired of doing it.
Right.
And also at the same time, it was really the only thing that I had that absolutely killed consistently, whereas my other act did not. But my other act was more true to who I am, and that's the act I really want to do. So it gave me a bit of a complex, I got to say, the fact that under my own name I was unpopular, but with this shticky character, it was a tremendous success.
The character's name, Shecky Gray.
Yeah.
That's a great name. Obviously, part of that name is from Shecky Green, correct?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's funny, the name Shecky is always used as a parody of a bad comedian. I was very young at the time. I was 21, 22, 23, 24 when I was doing that act. And I actually had no context for old comedians at that time. I just knew the name Shecky and used it. But in researching this book and doing my research over the past 2 years, I discovered that my parody was stunningly accurate.
Yes.
By accident. That I was meeting all these, giving them a raw deal. They all had voices like this. And they were complaining, oh, that guy was a son of a so-and-so. You know, they would always go off on me as I sat across from their breakfast table eating bagels and lox. You know, guys like Jack Ritter. And the real Shecky Green,
yeah.
All of these guys were incredibly angry offstage and hilarious offstage, but onstage they were charmers in tuxedos, very ingratiating, talking about how much they loved to entertain, whereas as soon as they were offstage, it was the exact opposite. It was just a cranky old man on public transit that you were talking to, basically.
Well, I got to tell you, Cliff, you capture that perfectly in the book. I'm halfway through the book, and, covering, television and all the early stuff. I want to get into that as well. But like Jack Carter is extensively quoted so far in the book, and every time he opens his mouth, he just seems really pissed off.
Yeah, he's hilarious, right? Jack is a strange anomaly. He holds the record for the most appearances of any stand-up comedian on the Ed Sullivan Show, but nobody seems to understand why or know why. He was Ed Sullivan's comedian. He was nobody else's favorite comedian. He did old old school style joke telling, you know, about the, you hear the one about the guy and girl who went to the discotheque? Oh, these kids, they got crazy dances these days, don't they? They got the Froog, the Watusi, that kind of a thing. Nobody really enjoyed it, but he was always on TV, and I found him fascinating for that reason. And Eugene Levy actually notoriously parodied Jack Carter on SCTV as sort of an old-fashioned ham, you know. But I got to know him in real life, and he was a great resource for my book. At the age of 93, he had an incredible memory for obscure facts, dates, and comedians who he claimed had ripped him off.
Right.
But nobody was funnier to sit across from than Jack Carter, because he was just angry about everything. He was one of the first people with a comedy show on NBC. 1950, the Jack Carter Show aired 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., followed by the much more famous Sid Caesar program, Your Show of Shows. And when I talked to Jack Carter about that, what he had to say was, it was always Sid Caesar, Sid Caesar, Sid Caesar, and I was like crap. So that was the kind of enjoyable time I got to spend.
Yeah, it's wonderful in the book to read that when you do the section on Your Show of Shows. It's fantastic. Let's go back, though. First of all, the title of the book is called The Comedians, That seems obvious to me that it is inspired by the article that was written. You mentioned television, the golden age of television, about Milton Berle, and then eventually became a television drama with Mickey Rooney portraying Milton Berle, essentially.
Yes, I'm glad you said that. For a second, I thought you were going to say it's obviously inspired by the failed Billy Crystal series.
No.
Going to get ready to correct you there, because it has no relation.
No, it doesn't. It's taken from that. Did you have this title in mind, you know, as you were researching it?
Actually, not that one either, but I much prefer that story. The real story is that my subtitle was the original title. Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy was my title for the book. But then my publisher said, well, that's more of a subtitle. It's a little bit too lurid for our taste. So they slapped on the two words, the comedian.
Well,
and at that time, that Billy Crystal series was still on the air when they told me that. And I was like mortified that somehow people were going to think that this was like the coffee table book based on this failed cable series.
I'll tell you what, Cliff, I don't think you have any worries about people even remembering that series on
Thank
FX.
Goodness.
Yeah. I want to get into the heart of the book and everything, but I want to talk about the cover. The cover of this, I love the cover of this book. And the cover of this book is essentially a takeoff on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Tell me about how that came to be.
Well, I'm glad that you love the title. I'm glad that you love the cover. Honest to God, I had nothing to do with the cover. It had to do with the art department. They mocked it up. But it's funny. The one thing that people like to criticize, however, is the cover, because they feel that since it is a Sgt. Pepper's parody, there's a ton of comedians on the cover, but at the same time, some people aren't on the cover. And it has nothing to do with playing favorites or anything like that. Some people seem to think that's the case. But I will tell you this, I was so thrilled, I was so flattered to hear Richard Lewis, who I interviewed for the book, and he really gave me a lot of the background on stuff that's in there about Larry David's early stand-up career. Richard Lewis loves the book, and so he showed the cover to a friend of his and said, hey, check out this Sgt. Pepper parody, Ringo. He showed it to Ringo Starr, so I'm over the moon.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
That's great. All right, well, let's get into it. You go all the way back to the beginning, man. And the book is set up chronologically, and there's some amazing stuff in it. And I want to get from the beginning. But I want to say this. Cliff, I'm halfway through the book right now, and I'm loving it. It's tremendous. But one of the guys whose quotes consistently make me laugh out loud while I'm reading the book is a guy that never really made me laugh when I would see him on old shows and old panel shows and game shows. I always thought he was okay, but the guy that kills me consistently with comments from your book is Fred Allen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, I know Fred Allen. I knew of him. I knew him through the old quiz shows and things like that. But man, his comments in this book are just hysterical. And I know that you had to find those comments because, you know, he's not around to be interviewed anymore. But tell everybody a little bit about Fred Allen, the people that might not know about him.
Yeah, of course. Fred Allen was considered one of the great cynical voices in comedy in the late 30s and throughout the 1940s. And even historians or just lay people kind of think of that era of comedy as sort of squeaky clean, kind of sanitized, very family friendly. And it was. But it was that way for a reason. It was because comedy was controlled by corporate sponsors on radio. So they really watered down any kind of incendiary discussion you could possibly have on the airwaves. It was the type of comedy that was least likely to offend and the most likely to sell Campbell's soup or whoever the sponsor's product was. So Fred Allen was a bit of an antidote to that. He was one of the first guys to sort of make fun of his sponsors, and not just make fun of his sponsors, but criticize them and criticize the NBC executives. There's a lot of quotes in the book about him complaining about how NBC could not, you know, come to any decision without a committee of 15 suits making that decision. So he tells it in a much funnier way, but in a joking manner. But he was really one of the first sort of subversive comedians to break through with any kind of mainstream success. You know, he was often associated in the public mind along with Jack Benny, who was considered the opposite of subversive, very mainstream. But because of that, Fred Allen's career went through ebbs and flows because a lot of the time he burned too many bridges. When he criticized NBC executives or his advertisers, well, then he often found himself without the support of that network and without the support of his advertisers. Yeah. And another guy who followed in his footsteps was Henry Morgan, who I also talk about in the book, who was more sort of salacious or more subversive than Fred Allen, but very much inspired by him. So for that reason, Fred Allen is also important. He was very influential on a lot of comedians who came later, guys like Mort Saul, who considered themselves a little bit more critical, a little bit more subversive. So, yeah, Fred Allen was very important.
Yeah, his stuff is very funny. In the book, you mentioned Henry Morgan, and what's funny about both of those guys is that they were staples on those late-night game shows, on the panel
shows. Right.
I mean, they really were. And they spoke out against that kind of stuff, too, and then they ended up on those shows.
Well, it's interesting. Those quiz shows, those Goodson Todman panel shows, What's My Line, I've Got a Secret, they're very smart about how they cast those panels. They made sure that there were contrasting personalities. It was like the way you would cast a sitcom with the dumb guy, the pretty boy,
right,
the wacky neighbor. So those panel shows were the same thing. So you had like a sugar sweet person like a Betsy Palmer. You had kind of a straight man like a Bill Cullen. You had like a beautiful Miss America like Bess Meyerson. And then you had like this cynical guy who didn't want to play the game like Henry Morgan. There's this great moment with Henry Morgan on I've Got a Secret. Or sorry, it was on What's My Line. He was subbing in. And on What's My Line, one of the panelists was this guy, Bennett Cerf, who had been publisher of Random House. But he was one of these guys who wasn't funny, but thought he was hilarious.
Right.
So he's always cracking puns and telling boring stories that he thinks are funny on What's My Line. So there's this one episode. Henry Morgan has been introduced, and Bennett Cerf is up, and he's just up to introduce the host. And he goes, there's a very funny story about our panel moderator, John Charles Daly. Seems he's in the Poconos this weekend. And Henry Morgan interrupts and goes, how long does this story go on? There's this sort of ooh from the audience. Bennett Cerf goes, Henry, may I fish? And Henry Morgan goes, yeah, I wish you would. So...
Oh man, listen,
that kind of attitude was very rare in TV in those days.
Oh man,
fresh air.
All right, Cliff, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Cliff Nesteroff is with us. He is the author of a tremendous book called "The Comedians: Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy." And it is the history of American comedy. It's tremendous, great. And anybody who is a fan and a student of American comedy, this is a necessity to get. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll talk more with Cliff coming up after this on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trim Tower. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. Talk and text to 312-981-7200. You can check us out at Twitter, at Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show is the best way to stay connected. And on our Facebook page, you will find a link for all the information about the book that we're talking about right now. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. You'll find the info for the book, The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels in the History of American Comedy, a great book about American comedy. Its author is our guest, Cliff Nesteroff, and we welcome Cliff back. Cliff, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Nick.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. My pleasure. Let's talk a little bit about now, when you first got the inkling to write the book, did you want to cover, like, the American history of comedy from the beginning? Was that was that the inspiration?
No, not at all. Once again, not my idea. my plan, and this is a huge part of the book, it's all in there, so none of what I wanted in there got cut out or anything, but my idea for a book was a book about comedians and the mafia, because if you worked as a stand-up comic in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, or 60s, 9 times out of 10, boss was the mob, and it didn't matter if you were in Chicago, New York, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Miami Beach. Didn't matter. Wherever you were in America, 9 times out of 10, your boss was the mob. And I found that kind of fascinating. Everybody knows about the Vegas stories, and in Chicago, I'm sure you hear about the Shea Paree.
Yeah.
And people know about Frank Sinatra's connection to the mob, but what people don't realize is the reason Frank Sinatra was connected to the mob is because he performed in these nightclubs, and anybody who performed in these clubs was connected to the mob, including comedians. So I think it's much more interesting where a guy's job is ridicule rather than a singer. This guy's job is to make fun of things, but if he makes fun of the wrong person, then maybe his life will be in peril. And all these old guys I interviewed had stories like that, so I found that quite fascinating. That was the genesis of the book that I pitched.
Well,
Grove Press asked me to write a book that went back further and came back more current. Yeah.
You know, no, it's, I mean, it's, and that's in the book, obviously. And I think one of the most amazing stories about that time period where the mob was running everything is tell everybody about Joe E. Lewis. His story is, sure, is astounding.
Yeah, and I'm sure many people in your fine city are familiar with this story because it happened there. But Joe E. Lewis was an amateur comedian in the late 1920s. At that time, he was just billing himself Joe Lewis. And he was playing a place that's still there called the Green Mill Cocktail Lounge.
Yeah.
And he's performing there in, I guess, 27 or 28. And at the time, it was run by or was owned by Al Capone. And Joey Lewis was kind of a naive amateur comic. So he played there for a month or two, and then he got an offer to do a gig somewhere else in town. So he went and took that gig. His bosses at the Green Mill said, "You cannot do that. You do not have permission to go and work somewhere else." Joey Lewis said, "I don't need your permission. You're not the boss of me." And they said, "Yes, we are the boss of you." And so to teach him a lesson, a week later, two men went up to his hotel and slit his throat. And the only reason that Joey Lewis did not die is because the blood was pouring down the hallway. Somebody saw the trail of blood, followed it, found Joey Lewis just in time. He survived this attempted murder. However, his vocal cords were severed, so now he could no longer do comedy. He could not do stand-up. He could not speak. It took him 3 or 4 years to recover. He had a long, white, fleshy scar from his ear all the way across his throat for the rest of his life. And he did regain the ability to speak. He started doing stand-up again. By 1935, he was a major headliner. The reason was not because he was a brilliant comedian, but because he did not squeal on the people that sliced his throat. And because of that, he had the respect of the mob, and they made him a made man in terms of comedy. They had him headlining every major mob-run nightclub in America. They said, "Here's a guy who is not just a guy who didn't squeal, but also a survivor." And because of that, Joey Lewis headlined the Copacabana in New York, the Shea Paree in Chicago, Ciro's in Los Angeles, and El Rancho in Las Vegas for the rest of his life.
It's an unbelievable story. And, you know, a lot of comedians... tons of comedians in that era and even after that era have mob stories. It really is kind of remarkable. I don't think people realize just how widespread the mob had a hold on comedy, and that's covered in the book. What are some of the more, like, I know Jerry Lewis, I've read everything about Jerry Lewis. I happen to be a Jerry Lewis freak. And
Right.
And, you know, Jerry Lewis had had run-ins with the mob where they were like, hey, knock off what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
It's like you made fun of the...
Well, when Martin and Lewis were playing the Copacabana, that's where they had most of their mob contact. And the mobsters loved Jerry Lewis because he was this cocky young kid. They kind of liked the fact he was an idiot and didn't know who was who. But it did backfire every now and then on some humorless mobsters. Albert Anastasia apparently tried to stab Jerry Lewis with a fork in the Copacabana lounge once. But the Copa is rumored to have been, well, not just rumored, now it's been verified. But at the time, it was rumored to have been owned by Frank Costello and Vito Genovese, who eventually took over that crime family. And whenever Joey Lewis opened, that was considered mob night at the Copa. Jack Carter told me that the lounge there was just filled with every major mafioso from the northeastern United States whenever Joey Lewis opened at the Copacabana, and I'm sure they came and saw Martin and Lewis as well. Dean Martin's mob contacts are no secret either, but really that was just par for the course. It's not that Dean Martin or Frank Sinatra or Jerry Lewis were shady guys in any way. They were just guys who were playing these nightclubs, yeah. And so of course they knew every mobster in America.
When did the hold that the mob had on comedy, when did that start to go away?
It eroded in the night. Well, two things happened. Mob control in America eroded in the late 60s. But in terms of them dominating nightclubs around America, it started to change in the early 1950s when a senator from Tennessee, which some people will recall, a guy named Eustace Kefauver, a very strange name, took it upon himself to try and drive the mob out of urban areas. There was a lot of splashy stories in the news. A lot of mob hits were front page news. And civic governments were being embarrassed because it was being exposed. A lot of them were in the pocket of the mob. So this guy, Kefauver, took it at his banner cause. He kind of had ambitions of running for president, and he felt like he should run for president on this sort of issue. So he held some very famous crime trials. This is when Frank Costello was called to the stand in New York. It was shown on television, but they had to broker a deal with Frank Costello that wouldn't show his face. They'd only show his hand. And when he took the stand, he said, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. That's when that phrase kind of entered the American lexicon. Mm-hmm. So Kefauver helped amplify harassment of mobsters around America. Civic governments were embarrassed when they were exposed as being on the take. And they all were in a race to see who could come down on the mob harder. So because of this, the mob was very frustrated. And after several years of this stuff, having to fight back and sort of prove their innocence, which they couldn't, they kind of all picked up their chips and moved to Nevada. And Las Vegas started to build in the early 50s. That's why when Las Vegas started to boom in the 50s, you hear these stories of how, oh, it was the Cleveland mob. Oh, it was the Salt Lake City mob. It was these guys were from Chicago. These guys were from Florida. All over America, the mobsters came together and kind of found solace in Nevada. So that kind of changed things. Then the showbiz hub of Miami Beach started to peter out. It was replaced with Las Vegas. And when the other supper clubs like the Chez Paris shut down across America, they still thrived in the hub of Las Vegas. So that was a big change. Mm. And then in the late 60s, Howard Hughes came into Las Vegas and started buying up hotels and changing the way they were operated, made things much more corporate. And that's when the corporations started to come in. They followed in the footsteps of Howard Hughes, and they kind of did the same thing, said that they were a white horse that would drive out the mob from Las Vegas. And ultimately, most of the comedians I talked to much preferred the mafia-run Las Vegas to a corporate Las Vegas. Mm.
Now, you know, in the section in the book about New York and you know the theaters that would showcase the comedians there is a wonderful section that you bring to life about the delis where the comedians would hang out and the restaurants and like how Lindy's was the top and then what was the I'm blanking right now on the name of the one that was like the that was the bad one
There was a hierarchy of delicatessens and hangouts, and depending on which one you hung out at, people knew what your standing was in show business. So Lindy's was for the star comedians like Milton Berle and Phil Silvers and Red Skelton and all the guys who had a big show on TV. Then the next step down was the stage delicatessen and the Carnegie delicatessen, which is featured in Broadway Danny Rose, the Woody Allen movie. And then one rung below all the others was a place called Hanson's Drugstore.
Right, Hanson's,
and
right.
This is where all the losers in comedy hung out, the guys who could never get a job, the guys who only did Jimmy Cagney impressions and nothing else. They all hung out at Hanson's Drugstore, but some of the people that came out of that scene did become big stars, most notably Lenny Bruce and Rodney Dangerfield.
Right, and Rodney Dangerfield's story is so great. Tell everybody his real name.
Well, his birth name is Jacob Cohen, but right. His initial show business name was Jack Roy.
Right, Jack Roy.
And he was a struggling schlepper. He did stand-up for quite a long time, and for whatever reason, just couldn't make a go of it. The people that I talked to who are in my book say it was because he was an unlikable person. He had no pretense. He did not ingratiate himself to the audience. He went up on stage, he held his audience in contempt, and it showed. It wasn't the character. So for a reason, Rodney struggled under that name Jack Roy for a long, long time. His wife wanted him to get out of show business. He wasn't making any money. And he did get out of show business, although he resented his wife for making him do so. He got into the construction and aluminum siding and repair business. But as I tell this story in my book, this is some new information Rodney does not mention in his memoir. He was doing this home repair business, but it was a big scam. He would pry on widows and the mothers of fallen soldiers and knock on their door and say, ma'am, I know you've had a recent tragedy. I, too, am a serviceman, a veteran, and thanks to the United States government and the GI Bill, I can get you discounts on home repair on your home. And he would take advantage of these women and then give them a bill for 10 times the cost of what actually the repairs required. So it turns out that after a couple years of doing this, the FBI started monitoring Jack Roy, a.k.a. Rodney Dangerfield, and arrested him at 5 in the morning after 10 months of gathering evidence against him. Eventually, he brokered some kind of a deal so that he would not have to go to prison, but he did lose the business. And in his memoir, he doesn't mention this. He just says that, I made good money, I made a good living in aluminum siding, but I wasn't living. It was time to get back into show business. But as I talk in my book about this, he changed his name to Rodney Dangerfield to erase the stigma of this criminal record.
Yeah. And for those people who don't know this scam, Barry Levinson made a really terrific movie called Tin Men.
That's right.
Which covers that the kind of stuff that Rodney was doing before he became Rodney.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cliff, hang on, okay?
Yep.
Okay. Cliff Nesteroff is with us. He is the author of The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. He didn't set out to make a book about the history of American comedy, but he did, and he made a damn good one. So everybody should check it out. We get the link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. More coming up after this. All right. Good morning, everybody. Hi. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here. I'm your overnight dude, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Wednesday morning, and we are talking with the author of the book, The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. His name is Cliff Nesteroff, and we welcome Cliff back to the show. Cliff, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Nick.
All right. In doing this book about comedy, in interviewing comedies and doing in comedians and doing so much research, do you have some sort of psychological analysis that is found consistent in comedians? Are there certain characteristics that many comedians have?
No, not really. Not really. There's two types of comedians in my experience. Guys that are hilarious and guys that are not. It's funny, a lot of the older guys who I interviewed, they're so interesting to me because they lived in an era where being funny naturally yourself was not even necessarily a prerequisite. Like the really old timers, a lot of them did the same jokes. They were interchangeable, and almost all of them hired writers to write them and act. That doesn't really happen anymore to that degree. You know, it's mostly shows like the late night shows where there's a team of writer crafting jokes for these guys, and somebody like Jon Stewart, when he was doing The Daily Show, gets the credit for everything that he said the night before. But of course, there was a team of writers who were anonymous. More or less writing that stuff. So back in the olden days, stand-up was a lot like that. So it was sometimes to my surprise, sometimes to my chagrin, that I would interview some real old-timers in their 90s who could not be any less funny and could not be any less creative or artistic or perceptive about the world. but it's because they kind of had a door-to-door salesman style career where they learned the craft but did not necessarily need to have the spark of talent. That's not to say that they were all like that,
right.
But there were some old-timers who I encountered that were like that, and I found that very interesting. And a lot of them also lacked a great deal of self-awareness. A lot of these older guys, as I would interview them, it was almost like I was Ralph Edwards, This Is Your Life. They were reliving their career, and I would say, you played the town casino in Buffalo. What was that like? And they would say, oh, Cliff, I murdered them. I slayed them. There were lineups around the block. And little do they know that I'm sitting in front of my laptop while I talk to them on the phone. And I got the review right in front of me that says he died the death of a dog and nobody showed up. So there was a lot of that, you know, which I always found very interesting.
You know, it's funny if you talk about killing and dying, which is a term that is used in comedy to this day. But that those two words never applied more than to Albert Brooks and Bob Einstein's dad. It's a pretty legendary story. But my favorite quote is when you interviewed Bob Einstein, who a lot of people would know as Super Dave.
And Marty Funkhauser on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Exactly, Marty Funkhauser on Curb Your Enthusiasm. But you interviewed him, and everybody says to him, well, at least your dad, I mean, it's one of my favorite quotes in the book, at least your dad died while he was doing something he loved.
Yeah.
And then he says something about, yeah, okay, what does your wife do? Or what does your mother do? Well, she's a housewife. Well, why don't we go over to her house, and after she does the laundry, I'll blow her head off, and then you can say that she was doing something she loves. One of my favorite quotes in the entire book.
Yeah, hilarious, hilarious, yeah. That quote that's in there came, I'm glad he added levity to that situation. When I originally interviewed Bob Einstein and brought up the fact, for people that don't know, that his father, Albert Brooks' father, the same man, a comedian at a roast of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, dropped dead on stage, on the dais of the roast, as soon as he had finished his set and brought down the house. When I brought this up in conversation with Bob Einstein, I said, that story about your father, that is just amazing. And he went, no!
Yeah.
It's not amazing! My dad died!
Yeah.
That's not amazing! And he got really mad at me, and I went, oh my God, like I was immediately tried to backtrack. But that's when he told me that story about, well, at least your dad died doing what he loved. When I asked, well, what does your mother do? Oh, she's a housewife. All right, well, let's go over to her house while she's doing the laundry and blow her head off. At least she'll have died doing what she loved. Yeah,
That's a good Bob Einstein, man.
Oh, well, that voice, it echoes in my head. It haunts me to this day. He got so mad, and I was so mortified.
Well, you know, the way you actually describe it in the book, it's not funny. I mean, when you know, like that story, if anybody knows anything about comedy or show business, that's one of those legendary stories that you've heard. He killed, then he died. That's the punchline. Like you describe it, and it's the way it's described in the book, it's horrifying. It's horrifying what happened.
Well, let me give you another real quick horrifying story about a guy dying on
stage. Okay.
Joe E. Ross, not to be confused with Joe E. Lewis. Do you know who Joe E. Ross is? He was on the TV show Car 54, Where Are You?
Absolutely,
with
yeah.
Fred Gwynne.
Yeah.
He was the guy who went, ooh, 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 ooh. That's his big catchphrase for decades. So he was a stand-up comedian, not a great stand-up comic, sort of a low-class strip club comic from the 40s. But did stand up on and off through his whole career. Now, Car 54 went off the air in the early 60s. By the early 80s, Joey Ross, nobody cares about Joey Ross. The new young comedians that people like David Letterman and Jay Leno, nobody cared anymore about Joey Ross. So he took this gig. He was being paid $100. Some people say it was at an old folks' home. Some people say it was at some other kind of a rec hall or something, but not a good gig. He goes up on stage. He does his pretty stand-up act. Apathetic crowd. Halfway through the show, Joey Ross feels this clenching pain in his chest. He sits down on the side of the stage, has trouble breathing, and drops dead in front of everybody, just like Albert Brooks' father. All right, so the next day, his wife showed up because they did not have a lot of money at this point. They weren't quite destitute, but needed all the money they could for a funeral. So the woman went to the man who booked Joey Ross and said, oh, I'm Mrs. Ross, and I just wanted to pick up his payment. And the fellow says, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. Here you go. Here's $50. And she said, no. He's supposed to be paid $100. And the fellow went, yeah, I know, but he didn't finish the show.
Oh. Oh, man. Wow. Okay. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Cliff, can you hang on?
Yes.
Okay, hang on a second. Here we go. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. Cliff Nesteroff, what an unbelievable story. The book is filled with stories from the beginning of American comedy to now. It's called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. And we'll talk with Cliff a little bit more right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And having a good time here. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out Twitter, at Nick D Show. And the best way to be connected, constantly updated, interactive, is facebook.com/Nick D Show, where you will find a link to the book and all the information on how you can get a copy of The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. The author is Cliff Nesteroff, and we welcome Cliff back to the show. Cliff, thanks for hanging out with us. I really appreciate it. The book is just great, man.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, no, this is fun.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about some of the modern comedians now. We've talked about a lot of the old days and things like that, but was there a turning point? I mean, I know that in the 80s, there was a comedy club every 6 feet in America.
Right.
There was a brick wall put up and a microphone put in front of it, and that pretty much was the deal. How did that boom happen?
Well, there was a number of ingredients at play. A couple of them happened in the early 70s. When Johnny Carson moved the Tonight Show from New York to Burbank, it was 1972. It was the same year that the Comedy Store opened. So a lot of the comedians that they started to use on the Tonight Show were young kids coming out of the Comedy Store. And this was a great infomercial for the Comedy Store, the comedy club that's still there on the Sunset Strip here in Los Angeles. Because Johnny Carson would bring somebody up and he'd say, "This is young Freddie Prinze. You can see Freddie every Friday night at the Comedy Store." And so there was this little ad. And so people who wanted to do stand-up or did do stand-up elsewhere in America would hear that. And it created a bit of a impetus to either move to Los Angeles, which a lot of comedians did, or once that comedy club became successful, it gave people the idea to open up comedy clubs of their own. So that was the first little pang, as it were, to the boom. Then there was a book published in 1975 called The Last Laugh by Phil Berger. It was actually the first book to ever talk about the transformation of Rodney Dangerfield from Jack Roy. It also talked about George Carlin in his early days, Richard Pryor, Lily Tomlin, Robert Klein. And it was one of the very first, maybe the first book ever written about modern stand-up comedy, and for decades was the only book about modern stand-up comedy. Jerry Seinfeld read that book, and the next day he did his very first open mic. And that's a very common story with people of the Seinfeld generation. This book, The Last Laugh by Phil Berger, inspired them. Now, the other big thing that helped start this comedy boom was cable television. HBO did their first HBO special, New Year's Eve, 1975, Robert Klein's On Location special. It was very successful. They didn't know if anybody would watch it, but it was a huge hit. And that created a bunch of other stand-up comedy specials, one in which was called Freddie Prinze and Friends, hosted by Freddie Prinze, and featured a lot of those comedy boom comedians like Jay Leno, Tim Thomerson, Gary Muledeer, these names that are not that common now but were big then. Cable TV helped propel this boom. People saw these comedians on television. It made them want to go see those comedians in person. And, of course, it was also very cheap entertainment to produce. Like you said, all you needed was a brick wall and a microphone, and most of these comedians were not really getting paid. So all of those ingredients together kind of helped create the comedy boom that really exploded at the start of the 1980s. Mm-hmm.
And that lasted for quite a while, and then they started to fall off. We had a bunch of them here in downtown Chicago, and they lasted for a while, and like there was the Funny Firm, we had the Improv here, and a bunch of stand up places that kind of fell apart. The only one that's still running is Zany's, and in fact they have three locations here in the Chicago area. And Bert, who runs Zany's, Bert Haas, is a kind of a legendary guy, and I've worked at Zany's, and it's an incredible club. But there used to be clubs like that all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I do not miss their terrible names. They always had some stupid comedy pun. I always hated that. Whenever people are writing about comedy or trying to describe it, they always use these archaic phrases that nobody ever uses, like mirth the merchant of mirth. When does anybody use the phrase mirth in conversation except when they're trying to, like, name an article about comedy or a bad comedy club? But, yeah, that stuff used to drive me crazy. I don't lament or miss the death of that at all, but a lot of people are arguing that we're in a comedy boom right now, and I think we are to a degree. But with all these comedy podcasts, it reminds me of Comedy Records in the late 50s, early 60s. Back then, it was weird if a stand-up comedian did not have a comedy record. Now it's weird if a comedian does not have a podcast. So there's a great interest right now, and it's good for me because my book is coming out at the right time, I think, because of that. I'm getting in on it. I'm cashing in, Nick.
Yeah.
But you know, at the same time, every boom does also bust eventually. So yeah. This one will too.
Yeah. Well, you know, but right now, you're absolutely right. Every comedian has a podcast, and some of them are enormously popular. Like Adam Carolla's podcast is insanely popular. Mark Maron's podcast is really incredibly popular. There are many of them out there. Some of them aren't very good. Some of them are really good. The two that I mentioned, I think, are great. How do you feel about some of the podcasts that are out there?
Yeah, the two you mentioned are really the biggies, and both of those guys have my undying respect for the fact that they've made a living off of that alone. I mean, of course, they do many other things, but they all kind of spring from those podcasts now. You know, this should be off the record, but it's not going to be. I've seen the numbers for Mark Maron's show, how much he makes from his advertisers. It blew my mind because I didn't think there was any money in podcasting, but he does as well as any commercial radio show. So I think a lot of people that get into podcasting now, a lot of the comedians, I think maybe they have their eye on that prize. It's never going to happen, but in a lot of ways it reminds me of the late 80s, early 90s when every comedian was doing stand-up in order to get their own sitcom named after them.
Right.
It didn't happen most of the time, but it really inspires a lot of people to go after it. I think that's sort of what's happening right now, too.
Yeah. It's an interesting time for comedy. And, you know, how things have changed in terms of, like you're talking about sitcoms, and how does a show like Louie get made? I mean, it's, you know, and that's not a complaint. I absolutely adore that show. I think Louis C.K. is brilliant. But, you know, would you ever think, like, that would be a sitcom?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't even consider it. I consider it more of a drama myself.
Yeah.
I don't think that as an insult either. But simply because it stars a comedian, it gets immediately categorized as a comedy. It's a mix of both comedy and drama. Then again, a lot of comic films are like that. Obviously, Charlie Chaplin, many people. I hate the phrase pathos. It's another one of those words like mirth that drives me crazy. But people have talked about Charlie Chaplin's pathos. And I think that's kind of what they're getting at. And I think the Louis C.K.'s program is sort of like that. There is this sort of melancholic flavor to it.
Oh, yeah.
That annoys a lot of people who are going into it thinking it's just going to be a hilarious show because his stand-up is so comic. And then this show is much more downbeat. But I love the fact that comedians can get to that position of clout or power where they're allowed to take risks and try and be something other than just a wacky neighbor on a sitcom. I hope that is a trend where comedians with a creative and artistic bent are allowed to experiment a little bit and that the audience will come along with them and not necessarily come down on them because of it.
Yeah. You know, and I love the fact that FX just goes, go ahead, Louis, do whatever you want. You know,
it's like, yeah, it's great.
You know, and that show was absolutely brilliant. And there are many episodes that don't have a single laugh, which is fine. I mean, it's fine. He's doing some really important stuff, I think. So now let's talk a little bit about really quickly. The term stand up is explained in your book, like how stand up comedy, how stand up comedian became a term. Could you quickly explain that?
Yeah, again, this comes from an elderly comedian who never made it, a guy named Dick Curtis, very obscure guy, really nice guy. He used to play the Cloister in Chicago back in the day, and still alive. He's about 90 years old. His only claim to fame is a guest shot on the episode on an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show. But he told me this, because he performed at all these mob-run nightclubs in the 1940s, early 1950s. And, of course, back in those days, the mafia did not just run nightclubs, but they also often controlled boxing, the fight game. They managed a lot of fighters. They owned a lot of fighters. And a boxer who was a dependable, tough guy who could go up there and take a lot of abuse but always stand up and not fall down was considered by the mob a stand-up fighter. Now, a guy who did not rat out somebody or squeal, kept his mouth shut, did not speak when he saw something lurid, the mob called that guy a reliable person, a stand-up guy. So a stand-up writer, a stand-up guy, a comedian they could depend on in the nightclubs, like a Joey Lewis, somebody who they could always count on to bring in a crowd. Well, that was considered a stand-up comic. So that's where the term comes from.
And it's still around to this day, obviously. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Cliff, like I said, I only got the book a few days ago, and I'm halfway through, and I'm tearing through it, and I love it. I think it's great. And it's right up my alley. I'm really interested in the history of comedy. And man, you've done a meticulous job with this. It's just tremendous. Talk a little bit about some of the people that you interviewed, because you interviewed some legends for this, and you interviewed some major voices. Who were some of your favorite interviews, and who else appears in the book?
Probably my favorite, maybe not even just my favorite interview, my favorite person, period, in show business, maybe in the history of comedy, is a guy I call Kaminsky, but you know him best as Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore Mel Brooks. I had the chance to meet him. When Sid Caesar died, Conan O'Brien did a Sid Caesar tribute that was an hour-long episode. Mel Brooks was the guest, and I have a lot of friends that work over there, so I was invited to attend. And my friend Jim, who books the bands there, said, do you want to hang out with Mel in the green room? I said, yes, of course, obviously. So I was hanging out with him in the green room suddenly. I'd never met him before, and I introduced myself, and we were talking. And he was about to go into makeup for this thing, and I said, you know, Mel, I do some events here in Los Angeles at this place, Fairfax Avenue. We're going to have a screening of the Your Show of Shows theatrical performance film when they pitched all the sketches together and put it out into theaters, Ken from Your Show of Shows, and I would love to have you there as my guest. And Mel Brooks said, yes, absolutely. When? Where? Tell me. I'll bring people. Absolutely. And so I booked Mel Brooks for this show. Now, Mel Brooks goes in the makeup room to be brought onto the Conan O'Brien program. I go out into the parking lot and get on my cell phone. I immediately called that theater. I said, listen, do you have any holes on the schedule? I know this is last minute, but I just told Mel Brooks that we're doing a show that's a tribute to Sid Caesar. Could we please put that on the schedule? Because I just booked him. I know I stepped out of line, out of boundaries. I know. Just totally made it up, and he agreed, and so we it was a little bit of old school showbiz blusterism, a little bit of bluster. I love the old timers.
That's great.
A lie to get to where you want to be. So
that's great.
I booked him first, and then we put the show together, and I do a show with Mel Brooks a couple weeks later, and it was a highlight of my life.
Wow, that's great.
Let alone writing this book. He's just a delight.
Well, it's a great book, Cliff, and you know, it's funny you mentioned that you had friends over at Conan. You know what I was looking at? I know that you had nothing to do with the cover, as you mentioned earlier, but I, for some reason, I adore, not for some reason, because I love the guy, but I adore the fact that Smigel is on the cover of the book.
Robert Smigel, there's just Chicago comedy history.
Oh, absolutely, but I just love it. You know, I'm looking at this book, and I'm like, oh, okay, and then I look at the cover, and I'm like, wait a minute, Robert Smigel's on the cover of this book about the history of comedy. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, he's really a very influential guy. People don't realize that among the people in comedy who he is responsible for having their first paid professional TV jobs include Bob Odenkirk, Louis C.K., Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert, Charlie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Kaufman, and Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
That list again, Conan O'Brien, Carell, Stephen Colbert, Louis C.K., Bob Odenkirk. It was Robert Smigel who hired all of these guys, either as writers at SNL or as performers on the Dana Carvey Show. And these are the most influential names in comedy today. So for that reason alone, aside from the fact that he's a brilliant comedy writer, Robert Smigel deserved enormous props.
Oh, yeah. And not only that, he's Triumph, for God's sake.
He's Triumph, the insult comic dog. That's I did a show with he and Triumph in Brooklyn for my launch a few weeks ago, and it was an amazing delight. I went up there on stage to say, ladies and gentlemen, Robert Smigel did this. I just told you, Louis C.K., Bob Odenkirk, blah, 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 blah. And then out of the curtain, Triumph's head pokes out behind me and goes, get on with it! This is so boring! Nobody cares! Oh, K.F.P.F. Just spell your name K-L-I-P-H! K-L-I-P-H! That is just one of the only thing that is interesting about you!
That
was a great delight to be roasted.
That's great.
Thanks,
well, it's a really, really great book. Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels in the History of American Comedy. It's called The Comedians, and Cliff Nesteroff is the author. Thanks, man. It's been a real delight talking to you, man. And the book is great. I can't wait to finish it.
Thanks so much, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Cliff Nesteroff, and again, he spells it as Robert Smigel's Triumph, the insult comic dog, said it's an interesting way to spell your first name. It's K-L-I-P-F Nesteroff, and the book is called The Comedians. Highly, highly recommended. All right, we'll take a break here on WGN.